Okay. Sorry for the delay. I just wanted to make sure that it was possible to have this file up here in case I mentioned things that you might not have heard of or whatever. What I want to talk to you about today, and I first want to thank Luke Mason for inviting me here, is about, I think, an issue that's very much related to what Dan was talking about in his last talk, and it has to do with this position that's called the proactionary principle, okay? And just to get a sense of, given that I've been told this audience is very avant-garde and on top of things and so forth, how many of you have heard of this, the proactionary principle? Raise your hands. Okay, I'm recording this and I'm getting a sense that maybe at most a fifth of you have heard of it. It is designed to be opposed to the precautionary principle, which I think is much better known. And in fact, in Google, there's a 50-to-1 ratio of the difference between them. And what the two principles have to do is with attitudes toward risk, okay? The amount of risk that human beings are willing to put themselves toward. And I think actually from the standpoint of people who, as I take it to be people in this room, are concerned about transhumanism and human beings reaching some sort of level of humanity 2.0, which I've written a lot about, that this is actually what, in a sense, what should focus your mind. Namely, the amount of risk that you're willing to put yourself and other people to in order to realize this quest. So let me put this in the context of the kinds of issues that Dan was raising. Because one of the things that is very interesting about the history of technology, okay, the history of technology, is that whenever there has been an opportunity to offload or outsource things that humans have previously done to non-humans, especially machines of human creation, humans have done it. Okay? I think in, you know, when one, so for example, in the history of capitalism, when one talks about the paradigm case of entrepreneurship, which is in everybody's lips these days, right, the example is the automobile. Right, and the automobile is a very interesting kind of invention from the standpoint of the sort of thing we're talking about here. Because there is a sense in which if you were living at the end of the 19th century and you wanted to improve personal transport, in a sense, you could have done two things. And both of these things, I think, are still very much with us as options. Especially if one believes in the proactionary principle and believes in transhumanism. On the one hand, you might say, well, personal transport is very much conducted by horses or horse-drawn carriages or things of that kind. And what we need to do is we need to breed better horses. We need to genetically modify horses, and of course many horses have been bred in the past in order to serve human needs, as well as other animals have been bred in order to do that. Okay? So the idea of genetic modification as a way of making nature more amenable to human ends and to be able to amplify human ends has been very much part of what human history has been about and is very closely connected to what we call civilization. But the interesting thing is, this is not how it went. It is not how it went with regard to what we call the automobile. We basically decided a different path. Rather than saying that the way we're going to improve human personal transport is by genetically modifying the natural vehicles by which we have been doing it, we decide we're going to create a new thing from scratch, and that's going to be much better than any of that natural shit. Okay? And that's what we did, and it's called the automobile. And there's been lots of that's happened in the history of technology. We use this example, and this example comes from Joseph Schumpeter, the person who talked about, you know, entrepreneurship as creative destruction of markets and all this kind of stuff that you're all very much familiar with. Okay, this was the example. Okay, and the interesting thing about it was that there was a point at which something that was regarded as very important for what human beings could do, right, just got shifted out of biology into technology. Now, I think you should think about the history of an artificial intelligence exactly in this way. For better or worse, this is the trajectory. Okay, that there what is going on here? Well, it seems to me that one of the futures, of course, that one can think about and think about what the automobile has become is that the automobile, as it has developed in the course of the 20th century and in the 21st century, has basically not only been an offloading and outsourcing view, but it's also enabled a certain kind of self-debilitation to occur to human beings. Right? So human beings don't have to walk around so much. So they become fat and lazy and they get heart conditions and all this other kind of crap, right? They can get around places longer, in briefer period of time, but their physical bodies become less useful. So there is that kind of transformation that has actually taken place. And it's very marked in the kinds of societies that are very intensive in this kind of technological transformation. And so in a sense, you might want to think about whether artificial intelligence might go down that route as well as it becomes more developed. Okay? So that's one point. And this might worry you, it might not worry you. And I think whether or not it worries you has a lot to do with where do you place the identity of the human. Okay? Because there is a sense in which when we talk about human beings and we talk about transhumanism, I think there is a kind of default starting point still that we're talking about biological beings who will in some sense will remain the biological beings that they started out with through evolution, etc., right? And that we will sort of continue in that way in some kind of enhanced fashion perhaps. We'll become smarter, we'll have more gadgets that we can manipulate, but we'll nevertheless still remain in the sense that we understand today, recognizably human. But really, is that what's on the agenda? Is that really on the agenda? It's not so clear. It's not so clear. Now, I realize that we've got people in the transhumanist community who, as it were, talk about this through both sides of their mouths, and Ray Kurzweil is a great example of this, right? Because he's the pill-popping, 150 kind of 1950-style vitamin pills a day kind of guy, but also talking about uploading consciousness into machines that will continue his identity indefinitely. So he's placing bets on both sides, right? Because you might wonder, if you're a serious transhumanist, why the hell does this guy worry about pills? Why does he worry about vitamin pills and looking young and all the rest of it if what we're talking about is saying the human condition is something that needs to be extended indefinitely in whatever medium?
Because he doesn't know when that will happen.
Well, actually, he claims he does know when that happened. Otherwise, you wouldn't be in this room, frankly, okay? It's the people who believe these predictions who actually have become the transhumanists. Okay? Ray Kurzweil, don't underestimate the massive public relations job he has done to get you here today. So don't diss the man. The point is, the man is talking from both sides of his mouth, right? Because he is imagining that there might be this, you know, lovely Ray Kurzweil who remains in a kind of human form forever. But on the other hand, there's also the Ray Kurzweil who'll be uploading his consciousness into a machine and will become this artificial intelligence who will continue onward to the singularity. Now, those are two different future prospects, people. They're not the same. And so there's a sense in which, what are the lessons that one is drawing from the history of science, whether we're talking about the history of biology or the history of technology, to where we want to go with this transhumanist agenda, okay? Because as the proactionary principle says, in both cases, we're talking about embracing a kind of risk. Okay? A kind of risk. And in a sense, this is... I really think this needs to be kind of put on the table today because, you know, we live in a world now where there are already people who are able to live in a kind of in-between state. And these are the cyborg people. These are the people who have very advanced kind of prosthetic things attached to them. You know, Stephen Hawking might be seen as the poster boy for this. You know, prior to his annihilation of his girlfriend, Oscar Pistorius may have been seen in this vein. Right, right, these are the poster people for the cyborg existence that's in a sense in between what I'm talking about. Okay, so they've got a bit of that kind of artificial stuff into them, but they've also got the biological stuff going on. And the interesting thing, of course, is that when people do surveys showing what the as it were the normal bodied public thinks about these people, they're very positive. Okay. In other words, the best thing that's ever happened to the disability movement is cyborgs. Because what it does is it shows that disability isn't really a disability at all. In fact, it's providing a kind of alternative ability. Okay? And this has been very much about, and I think this is a very important kind of positive step in the direction of transhumanism, but it does kind of raise the question, what happens if, as it were, normal-bodied people from a biological standpoint suddenly want to become cyborgs, even though they don't have any particular reason to become one. Right? So in other words, I am so keen on Pistorius's flippers that I'm willing to get rid of my legs and get some of his legs. Okay? What happens then? Do we allow this? Is this part of the transhumanist freedom of choice? What gets called in the transhumanist literature as morphological freedom? Do we allow this? Under what conditions? Okay? Now this seems to me, this is, as it were, where you might say in the future, in the short-term future, where this issue is likely to arise in a serious way, because we are getting more and more cyborgs with public visibility who are very attractive figures. And of course, you know, of course they say, well, I don't actually feel the way a human being normally feels, but now I've got all these other capacities instead, and that's worth the trade-off. Right? Okay. Sorry, sir, wait till I finish. I appreciate you're eager to intervene. No, I like that. No, that's good, but let me finish, okay? Because it seems to me that in a sense, if we're talking about transhumanism as a movement that is going to go forward and influence politics and be informed in the kinds of ways that we have all been informed by, okay, we have to see what this means as a social issue, right? What are the social consequences of this kind of thing on the? Because it's quite clear that there is a nascent kind of interest in people upgrading, upscaling, whatever. That is there. There is no doubt about that, right? So there's a sense of, but the question is, how does that get organized in a way that actually enables us to retain the values of welfare and social justice that have been so long hard fought in the purely human community? Okay? Because as you probably know, those of you who are transhumanists, right, one of the big objections that comes, especially from the people on the political left, is that, look, why are you guys talking about enhancement? Why are you guys talking about uploading? When in fact, we still have a billion people who are in poverty, if not more, and the difference between the rich and the poor is just increasing even in the first world societies. Why are you people even on the political map? Okay, that's a serious objection to deal with, okay? And at the moment, as you know, especially given I'm speaking in the United States, you may know that there is a transhumanist presidential candidate, Zoltan Istvan. How many of you have heard of him? Almost as many as have heard about the proactionary principle, okay. Well, he's not having that much traction, I guess. But look, there is a transhumanist political party, and the fundamental plank of this party, okay, let me just write his name here, because I do think you should take him seriously, because insofar as you believe that transhumanism is some kind of practical political project that might, as you know, in the long term, end up affecting all of humanity, you need to be aware of the people who are actually promoting this in the political arena and getting media attention. So the guy we're talking about here is Zoltan Istvan. Okay, he lives in California. He's a science fiction writer, and he is at the moment what he's doing. And those of you who know him will know that he is driving the immortality bus across the United States. The immortality bus is basically a big coffin, and I defer to Dan O'Hara on the Egyptian thing at the end of his talk, a big coffin that's being driven across the United States to basically dramatize what the main policy point is of the Transhumanist Party, which is that we want a government that will guarantee that everyone can live forever. That is the main plank of the party. Okay? And Zoltan has some ideas about this. He basically thinks that we should basically take the defense budget of the United States, which is enormous still, and rechannel it into biomedical research so as to enable this kind of, you know, aging reversing kind of science to be able to flourish and to come up with some serious results that could then benefit everyone so they could all live forever. That is the Transhumanist Party ticket. Transhumanist Party at the moment does not seem to be committed to the idea that we should enable all human beings to upload their consciousness into machines by Ray Kurzweil's date. But rather, it is on this kind of biological side of things, namely that we should be changing the human condition biologically by the normal biological means so that we can live forever. Now, this raises a lot of questions, and the questions that it raises to my mind, okay, and again, I'm speaking to you as people who already accept the sort of transhumanist premises. I don't think the problem is a scientific problem. I actually do believe that if we do put enough money and we put enough energy into this and we really take it seriously, we can probably reverse the aging process. I actually am not skeptical about that. What I'm skeptical about is what the implications are, and especially at the political level, especially if there are people out there who say no, right? They don't want this. And why might they not want this? Well, because most of social life is organized around the life cycle. And this is true across all societies. Our society, of course, have people living longer, to be sure, but nevertheless, we do sort of imagine that people are doing certain things in their lives at certain ages, and then they go off the stage, and then they may have a limited form of retirement when they're given some kind of benefit, but then they disappear. And as we already know from the pensions crisis across the first world, one of the things that even the people who designed the welfare state didn't anticipate was that people, that most people, would live considerably beyond the age of 65. Okay? That by itself, without any transhumanists intervening and doing anything, has already created a sort of crisis about what it means to live a decent human life. Last night I listened to the Republican presidential debate, which is very interesting because, do we have a problem here? Ooh, this doesn't look good. I pulled it. You guys, for transhumanists, I gotta say, yeah, okay. Hello? Okay, I'm gonna hold this, okay? Don't worry, it's all on the, I'm recording this, don't worry. But I was listening to the Republican debate last night, and I heard the whole thing in its entirety, and I was really struck by the kinds of issues that was being raised, believe it or not, by the governor of New Jersey, Chris Christie, where he was talking about how we have to stop this entitlements culture, and how we have to raise the retirement age gradually so that we don't end up bankrupting the United States government. Okay, he's very serious about that. Now, it seems to me that if you're a transhumanist, you gotta pay attention to something like that. Because what's the point of having all these people living around forever as long as we have rules that say that people can continue to retire at 65? Right? So we need a new reorganization of society, a new restructuring of society, unless you want the next generation always to be subsidizing the previous generation. And this is why I say, with regard to where transhumanists should be, on the issue of the extension of life and where humanity should go and so forth, the question should not be whether everyone is guaranteed a right to immortality, but rather whether we live in a world where people can decide when to live and when to die. Okay? And we can also, and this is where the Ray Kurzweil thing becomes quite interesting, is when we have an option, as it were, to transition into a different form of being that is legally recognized as our own identity. That is to say, the identity we previously had in our biological lives, but now transferred to a primarily silicon-based medium. And to have the legal rules that allow that sort of thing to happen. Rather than, at the moment, what somebody like Zoltan Istvan seems to be promoting, which is the idea, we'll just have everyone live in their biological bodies forever, and this won't require any kind of substantial change to the way in which the rest of the society is organized. Okay? So I do think that the issue at stake here, and I'll close with this remark for the transhumanists, is that the issue that needs to be confronted is what is it exactly about the human that is in transhumanism, okay? Because we have a phrase, as you may know, called post-humanism, which basically is telling humanists to get over themselves and saying that the world is not really about the human, it is not really anthropocentric, and it isn't really that kind of thing. So there's post-humanism, and I think some of you may have heard of this. But when you call yourself a transhumanist, what you're really saying is, actually, there isn't anything wrong with the human, we're just trying to bring it to the next level. We're trying to perfect it. We're trying to really achieve it in a way in which we haven't been able to do before, okay? And then the question becomes, what is it that you're trying to perfect or achieve? What is it about the human that you want to have remain constant as we make all of these transitions, whether we're talking about extending life indefinitely or we're talking about uploading human consciousness into the machines? And those are two quite different options, and there are also these cyborg options in between. But in any case, it is not too early to start thinking about them. Thank you.